Deutsche Welle, Living Planet. This week on Living Planet, a Dutch court issues a mixed verdict on an oil spill case against Shell.
It looks like a World War One movie. It looks so absolutely terrible. The oil has devastated the mangroves. There's virtually no vegetation in much of the area. The greatest worry is this is a fishing community where there's now no longer any fish.
Hunted nearly to extinction, wolves roam back into Germany's forests.
We still suffer the fairy tale of the Little Red Riding Hood, and everybody thinks, if wolves are around, I cannot go into a forest anymore. I have to avoid the forest. And this is nonsense. The wolf is so afraid of humans that it's extremely hard to see a wolf.
And a battle continues between farmers and indigenous groups in Brazil.
The indigenous, they are tired of waiting for the Brazilian government to take action. And they are what they call retomada, or getting back their land.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. We start this week in the Bodo region of the Niger Delta, a region that has been blackened by oil. On a trip through the area, writer John Vidal wrote, "The air stinks, the water stinks, even the fish and crabs caught in the Bodo Creek smell of oil." The oil has found its way deep into the village wells. It lies thick in the mudflats, and there are brown and yellow slicks all along the creeks, swamps, and mangrove forests. Experts estimate that 13 million barrels of oil have been spilt in the Niger Delta since exploration began there over a century ago. That's like having the equivalent of the Exxon Valdez every year for 50 years. Well, 4 years ago, farmers decided to take action. They filed suit against oil giant Shell. Now, Shell denies responsibility. They say the spills are the result of criminal tampering. And in most cases of sabotage under Nigerian law, oil companies are not responsible. A Dutch court has now rejected part of the case. Only one of the farmers has been granted compensation. Royal Dutch Shell declined our request for an interview but sent us this statement.
Oil pollution is a problem in Nigeria. However, the vast majority of oil pollution is caused by oil thieves and illegal refiners. The court has, quite rightly, largely dismissed the claims.
I spoke with lawyer Martin Day, who represents the Bodo community in the ongoing case. He told me a little about the spills and his reaction to the court's decision.
What happened was back in 2008, there were two very large spills that took place in the area of Bodo, which is in the Niger Delta. We say that many hundreds of thousands of barrels spilled out from the pipeline that takes oil from the wells down to a terminal near the Bodo area. I've been there many times, and it looks like a World War One movie. It looks so absolutely terrible. The oil has devastated the mangroves. There's virtually no vegetation in much of the area. The greatest worry is this is a fishing community where there's now no longer any fish.
Today, the Court of The Hague has ordered Shell to pay damages to one farmer, Mr. Friday Akpan. The company was found guilty of neglecting its duty of care. Could you explain what that means?
Well, the crucial issue here is that it's the first time that we have seen Shell being found responsible for an oil spill. And one of the big things that happens in the Niger Delta is that there is, because of so much poverty around, that there is quite a lot of illegal activity going on, of individual criminals going in there trying to steal some of the oil. And that caused a lot of the devastation. And Shell basically washes its hands of it, saying, well, that's not our fault. Well, in this case, in The Hague today, the Dutch court is actually saying, well, there is still a responsibility on you, Shell, and if you don't properly protect your pipeline, then we will hold you liable for the damage that this caused.
So are they being held liable for the damage also caused by people going in and trying to collect the oil that had spilled?
Yeah, I mean, that's the crucial point, is that in our case, in the Bodo case that we've been talking about, is that there Shell acknowledge the damage was resulting from pipeline failure, which they already accept is their fault. What's different in the Dutch case is that the Shell was trying to deny responsibility, saying that it was not their fault, but these criminals who came in to steal the oil. And the fact that the Dutch court has said that they are in fact liable for at least one of those spills is really a pretty important development.
Now, in a statement released today, your firm said you, quote, cautiously welcomed today's ruling. Why the tempered reaction?
Well, the fact that the court decided that four of the five cases Shell were not responsible we felt was disappointing is there's lots of evidence to show that there's a lot more that Shell could do to stop the illegal actions that are taking place and devastating these communities. And we feel that Shell should be held responsible for those circumstances as well. So whilst we were very pleased about the one case, we did feel a little disappointed about the other four.
When you say that Shell should have been doing something, what should they have done?
Well, there's many things that they could have taken, many more steps that they could take to try and prevent these illegal actions. They've been going on for now about 10 years, if not longer. There's lots more they could do. This is a very old pipeline, 50 years old. What they should be doing is burying it a lot deeper, putting a concrete coating on top to try and stop the ease with which the criminals can get access to the pipeline, and having better monitoring systems. The problem is that the pipeline is so old that often it will go many days, if not weeks, before the spills are even known.
When criminals go in to steal the oil, how are they contributing to the damage?
Well, what happens is they drill a little hole into the pipeline and then siphon off the oil as it flows through the pipeline so they can take it to local refineries. So there are two sources of the oil. Firstly, that process of drilling into the pipeline can result in quite a lot of oil being leaked out. But secondly, when they then refine it locally, then again, there's often lots of residual oil that gets tipped out into the local creeks and rivers.
If we could turn for a moment to the other farmers in the case who weren't successful in their claim, on what grounds were these other four cases brought by Nigerian farmers dismissed?
What happens in Nigeria, and in the end, the Dutch judges are applying Nigerian law, and that's exactly the same that will happen in the UK. It's the Nigerian law that actually applies. There's something called the Oil Pipelines Act in Nigeria, which basically says that Shell is responsible for any oil spill and damage resulting from oil spills that were the failure of the pipeline, i.e. Where there's mechanical failure of the pipeline. So they're responsible for that, but they are not responsible where it is the acts of others like this illegal sabotage. And so for the four, the Dutch court decided that there was not sufficient negligence on behalf of Shell to mean that they should be held liable in those four cases, which was different to the fifth, where they were saying that there was something more specific that they could do.
How will this ruling affect other oil spill and corporate responsibility cases in Nigeria?
Well, I mean, it is a positive judgment in saying that, yes, the court is prepared to look beyond just whether the spill was caused by mechanical failure or was sabotage. So it's saying that there are circumstances where it will still hold an oil company liable, even where it was illegal activities that caused it. Now, that's a very important move forward, the first time that's ever happened. So I think it will mean that companies, and obviously Shell in particular, because it's so prevalent there, will be very, very wary about where it's left as a result of this judgment.
How are we connected to this? Is there any way that consumers can be more active in guarding the safety of the communities that you work with where oil is being sourced?
Shell basically washes its hands of the fact that hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil have been left to leak out into the communities of the Niger Delta. And if it had happened in any of our communities, we would have all been massively up in arms. And as we saw with BP in the Gulf of Mexico, the pressure that was brought to bear by public opinion, public pressure, the president himself, the media, meant that the head of BP had to stand down, and it caused massive damage to BP's reputation. Now, the problem with the Niger Delta is that it is such a big distance away, very few journalists go. But I think what local people can do in your country or in ours is put pressure on Shell to say that even though these are far away distances, we totally relate to the people of these communities whose lives have been devastated by the oil. And we do not accept, Shell, that you just can wash your hands of the responsibility and put it onto others, that in the end you are the ones who are pumping out the oil, you're making the profits. We expect you to act in exactly the same way in Nigeria as you would in Germany, the Netherlands or the UK.
Martin Day is the senior partner at the London-based law firm Lee Day, which is representing the Bodo community as they sue Shell for damages due to two oil spills in 2008. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
as sly as a fox, as strong as an ox, as fast as a hare, as brave as a bear, as free as a bird, as neat as a word, as quiet as a mouse, as big as a house. As mean as a wolf, as sharp as a tooth.
The return of wolves to Germany's forests should be a great success story. They were hunted here almost to extinction. Now wolves from Russia and Poland are slowly scampering over the border back into the forests. But people are terrified of wolves, and it's no wonder. From Little Red Riding Hood to the howling in horror films, we are told that wolves are dangerous enemies, lurking in the forests, hungry for blood. So while German wildlife lovers are thrilled to see the wolf population rebound, locals are a little less enthusiastic. Michael Scatoro has this report.
The Leibniz Institute for Zoo and Wildlife Research on the outskirts of Berlin is like one big animal museum.
So this is the Leibniz Institute for Zoo and Wildlife Research. Okay. It belongs to the Leibniz Society, which is...
The walls are lined with skeletons and tissue samples of everything from monkeys to tigers. In the lobby, a baby elephant in formaldehyde greets visitors. It's here that Oliver Krone and his team perform autopsies on German wolves found dead in the wild. He shows me photos of a wolf that was apparently pursued and then plowed down by a car this past autumn.
So this was a fenced little road in the forest, and we were able to measure the tracks of a running wolf, of a German wolf trying to escape a car. Then the car came, crashed the wolf, and moved away. And this was intentionally because it was a straight way, and the wolf couldn't escape because on the right side and on the left side there were fences. So the wolf has to keep on the road. And then this car came from behind, accelerated, and killed the wolf.
The wolf's return has been met with excitement in the scientific community and anger by sheep herders and others who raise livestock. Krone says wolf packs from Russia and Poland are making their way into Germany, settling mostly in Brandenburg. Wolves from Switzerland, France, and Italy have also been found. Because the animals are endangered, no one is allowed to kill them, but Krone says the ban is being ignored.
So we were able to say that one wolf was intentionally killed by car, but a larger proportion is intentionally killed by hunters, so they have been shot. And we are only getting those wolves which have been badly shot into the belly or into the abdomen or somewhere there, but it was not a lethal shot in the first instance. The good shots in which the wolves are dying immediately are taken away. Those wolves have been taken away by the hunters and they're buried somewhere, so we are not getting those.
Animal rights groups and the Brandenburg state government have come up with a plan that they think will appease conservationists and livestock owners. Since 2007, wolves have killed about 360 farm animals. Owners have been compensated in the past on an ad hoc basis. Katharina Weinberg from the Brandenburg arm of the conservation group NABU says the new plan will treat farm owners more fairly.
The people dealing with the administration of this are very few in number. That's why the reimbursement takes a little while. But it doesn't take half a year to get money back. It's more like 8 weeks. That's not too long. The farmers have a difficult situation. Economically, things aren't going well for them. That's the reason why this is such an issue. Sehr schnell hochkocht und
sehr schnell schwierig wird. But Lutz-Uwe Kahn of the Brandenburg Farmers Group isn't satisfied with the plan. He says farmers in his group have had to wait up to a year for reimbursement for dead livestock and money to train sheepdogs.
The solution for us is to allow the wolves to live where they live now, in nature parks and on land owned by the army. But if they leave these places, we need to be able to hunt them, because if we don't, they'll attack our livestock.
Kahn said he and his group were alarmed when wolf pups pursued an army soldier last September.
The soldier really had to scare off the pups. You can only imagine how they'll be when they're older. These wolves that aren't hunted and which have lost their natural shyness could attack people.
Here in the empty forests surrounding Berlin, it seems hard to find evidence of wolves. But still, scientists say they are here. Residents who DW spoke to in the area have differing opinions on the danger that the animals pose to the community.
No, I'm not afraid of wolves. Actually, it's a real honor to see a wolf in the wild. They are very shy animals, so why should we be afraid of them?
Oliver Krone from the Leibniz Institute says that ultimately, the issue boils down to long-held biases in Germany against wolves.
So we still suffer the fairy tale of the Little Red Riding Hood. And so everybody is really afraid just by hearing the name wolf. And everybody thinks, if wolves are around, I cannot go into a forest anymore. I have to avoid the forest. And this is nonsense. The wolf is so afraid, is still so afraid of humans, that it's extremely hard to see a wolf. You can try. I mean, you would be so lucky to see a wolf. But this will never happen.
One thing is for sure, the battle here in Brandenburg between wolves and farmers is heating up. As for the public, they seem cautiously optimistic about the wolves' return. Michael Scutoro, DW, Potsdam.
We leave the forests of Germany now and travel to a disputed stretch of land in Brazil. The agricultural industry has claimed rights over territories where the Guarani Kaiowá make their home. This is one of Brazil's largest indigenous groups. Faced with eviction, they wrote a letter to the Brazilian government stating they would rather die than be expelled from their ancestral lands. The letter has been interpreted as a mass suicide warning and triggered demonstrations across Brazil. Katie Sharif has more.
Urban youngsters dressed up like Indians dance and sing in Sao Paulo's city center. They demonstrate against the poor living conditions of the Guarani Kaiowá Indians in the region of Mato Grosso do Sul, on the border with Paraguay.
To give the indigenous people their land. They've been fighting for decades. Now in this moment, because of the dramatic letter, all the people of all this country are hearing their voice.
Meu nome é em Guarani Apucarandu. Guarani Apucarandu.
Apucarandu is one of the Guarani Kaiowá Indians who wrote a desperate letter. They occupy a small part of farmland, which is part of their ancestral grounds, but now belongs to farmers. They are threatened by gunmen to leave the land.
Histórico, decidimos primeiramente.
Their letter wasn't about mass suicide. But the message is just as desperate. If you want us to leave our soil, you'll have to kill us.
Atenciosamente, Guarani Kaiowá de Pielito Coelho Baracai.
Brazil's economy is booming, and the agricultural sector is one of its most important engines. Soy and sugarcane plantations are popping up everywhere.
And you see the region, the south of Mato Grosso do Sul, which is the border of with Paraguay. I mean, the soy is growing really fast there.
Verina Glass from the NGO Reporte Brasil investigated the indigenous problems related to soy and sugarcane expansion in the region of Mato Grosso do Sul.
This commodity in the international markets, you know, the prices are going up. The better the prices, the more is the pressure on the land in Brazil.
In Mato Grosso do Sul, ground prices doubled in only a year's time. Brazil's farmland now belongs to the most expensive in the world. Attorney General Delfino de Almeida works on behalf of the Brazilian federal government on the recognition of indigenous grounds in the region. But this process will take many years. After recognition by the federal government, farmers can appeal against the decision. Now that ground prices are soaring, farmers don't want to lose their land.
So what's happening in Mato Grosso do Sul is a war because the indigenous, they are tired of waiting for the Brazilian government to take action. And they are what they call retomada, or getting back their land. So they are going in to these areas. And then you have the problems with the farmers.
Last August, a farmer with the nickname Black Handkerchief declared war to the Indians who occupied his farmland. The Guarani Kaiowá are the second biggest indigenous group in Brazil.
They're interesting people. They used to live in a huge area between Brazil, Paraguay, Argentina, and Uruguay, wandering around, and they had this search for the land without evil. And they are really a peaceful population. I mean, they can't stand violence.
For years, they have been living in harsh conditions.
The suicide rates between the Guarani Kaiowá is enormous. It's incredible. Teenagers, even kids, are killing themselves because they can't stand the situation they're living in, you know.
Last summer, energy giant Shell signed a landmark agreement giving up plants to buy sugarcane grown on indigenous lands.
And then we asked Bunge, for example, yeah, and why are you not doing the same? What we know, they are buying sugarcane from 5 farms inside the indigenous land of Jataivari.
Multinational Bunge still buys sugarcane from farmland that is already recognized as indigenous. But as there are still pending appeals from farmers, Bunge sees no problem in buying this cane. The company responds in an email that it's legally allowed to buy this sugarcane, as the final disposition of this land still has to be determined. They are legally right, says Attorney General Delfino de Almeida, but it is not in keeping with the company policy of sustainability.
Em cada colheita, a garantia de alimentos na nossa mesa e de milhões de pessoas.
All marketing of Bunge focuses on environmental and social sustainability.
Uma homenagem da Bunge Fertilizantes.
Verina Glass from the NGO Reporta Brasil.
It's not only Bunge, we have lots of international investors in Brazil. And for example, Louis Dreyfus, which is French, and we have some British other companies in Brazil, in Mato Grosso do Sul, with slave labor cases. Then we thought, okay, great. I mean, international, multinational companies are coming to Brazil. Maybe they have a better social or environmental policy. It's not. I mean, actually, what we see is they are doing it worse than the Brazilian companies.
Katie Sheriff for DW in São Paulo, Brazil.
Iceland is rolling back its dependence on oil and gas and investing in renewable energy sources like geothermal power. The tiny North Atlantic island is gaining quite a reputation for its progressive energy policies. It's also drawing foreign engineers and scientists who want to learn how to harness the heat of the earth. Alexis Rosenzweig reports.
Like all the open-air swimming pools in the Icelandic capital, the one at Laugardalslaug is heated by geothermal energy, a source that also provides heating for almost every single household in the country. Here at the pool, Bjarni Richter, a geothermal expert at state company Iceland Geosurvey, explains how it works.
We use the internal heat of the earth to boil water, to take the hot water and turn it into steam at the surface, and the steam is driving turbines that generate electricity. We started very early in utilizing geothermal energy, not only for power production, but initially for heating houses.
Resources of geothermal energy range from the shallow ground to hot water and hot rock found a few miles beneath the Earth's surface, and down even deeper to the extremely high temperatures of molten rock called magma. Almost everywhere, the shallow ground of the Earth's surface maintains a nearly constant temperature between 10 and 16 degrees. Geothermal heat pumps can tap into this resource to heat and to cool buildings. A geothermal heat pump system consists of a heat pump, an air delivery system, and a heat exchanger, a system of pipes buried in shallow ground near the building. For Iceland, the abundance of geothermal energy has meant the country has been able to shield itself somewhat from the fluctuating price of oil over the years.
Absolutely. In the main burst in the power generation in Iceland was when the oil prices or oil crisis was in 1970. Then we started heating our houses much more with geothermal energy to save on oil. This is clean energy, It is renewable if handled properly. It is sustainable if handled properly. And in the long run, it will be relatively cheap. It's easy for us here in Iceland to work from the high temperature area for the power production. Elsewhere in the world, there are new techniques getting better and better in getting geothermal energy on in areas that usually don't have volcanism or anything like that. It was more expensive than with oil and gas in the old days. But with the prices of oil and gas rising so much as it has over the last 10 years or so, then this is a very viable way to produce electricity.
And it could also become very profitable for Iceland with a project to sell electricity to the rest of Europe via a submarine cable to Scotland. But the president of Iceland, Olafur Grimsson, says his country will need international collaboration.
Building an electric cable that would link Iceland to Scotland and from there into the European grid, utilizing both hydropower and geothermal power in Iceland, is of course a very interesting project. The Icelandic power company, the national power company, has done extensive examination, and it is technologically feasible and seems on the face of it to make an economic sense. So it is a project that we have decided we will look into in a big way. But of course, it is so huge that we will never be able to execute it unless there is a wide-ranging European and global involvement in that project.
But it's also about the science, and Iceland is keen to export its technical expertise as it becomes a world leader in the field of geothermal energy. For more than three decades now, in cooperation with the University of the United Nations, the Icelandic government has trained engineers from developing countries. The geothermal plant located about 20 kilometers from Reykjavik is a first stop for all the 32 participants in this year's training program. Among them is Edna Ouko from Kenya, a country where geothermal energy is becoming very important. She is working on reducing the smell of geothermal energy, a disadvantage that visitors notice straight away when they take a shower in Reykjavik.
In fact, I'm doing a project on the smell, that's the hydrogen sulfide. But hydrogen sulfide is a byproduct of the drilling process and also just the powerhouse running. Even though right now there is technology that helps to reduce this, it's called scrubbing. It reduces the gas from the water. So the one that is released into the atmosphere has very little smell of that.
Ouko says she's learned a lot that she can take back home with her.
Most of the great geothermists I know went through this training. Yeah, so my country is growing in this way. Iceland has made tremendous growth in geothermal, and we have learned a lot because we have learned from their mistakes and from their successes, and we can take a lot from that.
And despite the financial crisis that hit the island a few years ago, Iceland's government has continued to finance the program, which is part of its contribution to the UN Millennium Development Goals. Alexia Rosenzweig, DW, Reykjavik.
Thank you to Alexis Rosenzweig for that report.
As mean as a wolf, as sharp as a tooth, as deep.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. For now, I'm Sarocha Coelho. From everyone here in studio, thanks for listening.
As pretty as a picture. as silly as fun, as cool as a tree, as scary as the sea, as hot as fire, cold as ice, sweet as sugar, and everything nice, as old.